Welcome to The Expert Approach. I'm your host, Joy Malik, a urology nurse practitioner. Here on this podcast, we bring together voices that are shaping the future of urology and uro-oncology by advancing patient care, driving innovations, and redefining the roles of advanced practice providers. Every conversation here, we try to highlight collaboration, innovation, leadership, and real therapies that are making impact in our communities. The goal of this podcast is simple: to find the purpose and the insights that spark a positive change. Today on The Expert Approach, I am joined by Dr. Mark Edney, a senior physician at Chesapeake Urology, and he's also the public policy chair of the American Urologic Association. Now, Dr. Edney has over 20 years of experience in urology and many accolades and accomplishments that he has achieved throughout this career and still continues to lead, not just in the OR, but in innovation, mentorship, leadership, and national policy initiatives. I have to share this on a very personal note. Since I joined Chesapeake Urology, Dr. Edney has been a mentor and a guide for me. He has always taken the time to ask me what direction I wanted to pursue in urology and have always actively helped me so I can get there. He's a leader who I have always seen consistently treating APPs as colleagues and pushes everyone around him so that they can excel, myself included. So, without further ado, Dr. Edney, it's great to have you here, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, Joy. Thank you for that very kind introduction. And I'm certainly very proud of you and what you've done with your career to the benefit of our community where we work together. And so you've done some phenomenal things yourself. But thank you very much for the very kind introduction.
So to start the show, over your two decades of career, you have accomplished a lot and you keep taking on different roles. So my question is, what keeps you going? I know it's not the coffee, so.
it turns out, once you get into urology practice, and it may be a little bit different for academicians, although there's some academicians who do a lot of health policy and advocacy work. In independent practice, you do have opportunities to get involved in research, but, in terms of how you keep things fresh outside of the clinical space, some folks, lean towards things, like advocacy and policy. And I certainly did that. And I've been doing that really since I started practice. I started doing things at the state level. We live in Maryland, so our state house is in Annapolis. Started to get involved in state level coalitions of urologists who wanted to go to Annapolis and plead our case. And that turned into multi-specialty coalitions. And that work led to sort of more work at the national level with the AUA itself and serving on health policy committees with the AUA. Did some work with the AACU, and I've been very fortunate. The more work you do, and the more you kind of hang around, the more you get asked to do. And so I think it's just fun. And I've been there a long time, and I do a decent job, I guess. And I keep getting asked to sort of take on this role or that role, and that's led. And I'm very blessed to have been chosen the chair of the Public Policy Council, which is my current role. But it's something I truly enjoy. To answer your question, I just truly enjoy it. There's a camaraderie. It's a relatively small group of us that are consistently involved in policy and advocacy and on committees and going to the state houses and going to Capitol Hill. So you develop a camaraderie with these folks, and it becomes just your a group of friends and colleagues outside of where you work that you look forward to catching up with and doing this work together. And sometimes when you score a win, you're scoring a win for the House of Urology, whether it's in your state or at the federal level. And that win accrues to all of your urologic colleagues, but most importantly, and the reason we do this, it accrues to our patients, because what we're fighting for is defending the things that we need to hold on to, going after legislatively and by way of policy, the things that would be good for us that we don't have yet, but also importantly, defending both at the state and federal level, defending against, you know, initiatives that would harm our ability to provide care for our patients, because those are out there. They're all over the place. And so we've got to be very vigilant for people encroaching on our scope of practice, for example, and really protecting the quality of urologic care across the state and really across the nation. And so that work is incredibly rewarding. Sometimes it's slow coming, and sometimes the wins are far and few and far between. But when you score a win with your colleagues because you put a lot of work into it, nothing better in my book. So it's just what I've enjoyed doing alongside my clinical work over the years.
No, that shows. And like you said, ultimately, you're trying to make sure that your community, your patients get the best care from the people that are delivering them. So I have to ask, like, you know, since you started urology, because urology is one of those practices that is kind of like surgical, but also has supplemental office space into it. And over time, with the new innovations, new treatments coming in, how do you see when you started versus now, surgery versus the office time, and how do you see in the future? Do you think it's going to stay more surgical with complementing with office, 50-50, or more office, less surgery?
I think that, you know, one of the beauties of urology and one of the things that attracted a lot of us to urology is it's a rare specialty where you have purview for a lot of disease processes. You have purview both on over the medical management and the surgical management. And it's been that way almost since the inception of urology. I think it was maybe a bit more procedurally heavy before we had a lot of medical interventions. You know, when you go back to sort of the genesis of urology back in the 20s and 30s, but through the 40s and 50s with all the scientific advancements and you know, everything coming out of the research universities, a lot of drug development and a lot more things we could start doing in the office. And so the office really bloomed. And there's so much we can do for patients on the office side. Alongside that, in parallel, there's been an absolute explosion in surgical technologies, you know, both for the larger surgeries. We'll talk about, you know, the Da Vinci robot and how that has revolutionized prostate and kidney surgery. But even smaller devices used both, say, in the BPH space. There's a range of minimally invasive options now in the BPH space. Penopelvic medicine. There's all sorts of device development in the advanced overactive bladder space. You know, the InterStim's been around for a while. But the ability to stimulate nerves in less and less invasive ways that are kinder and gentler for the patient continue to evolve. So it's really, I think we're extremely fortunate as urologists to be in a specialty that's a balance of office and surgery. And if your interests are more surgical, you can focus your career on a more surgical career. And if your interests are more office, there are urologists who don't do much operating. That's fine too. You can really find a niche for yourself, which is another real advantage. But I think both sides, you know, have been there, will be there, and it allows urologists to really tailor their careers, according to how they want to practice.
So this is like not a new news, but, you know, in medicine, there has been a shortage of physicians, and it's not just one subspecialty, but every specialty has its own like shortage coming up in the forward. How have you seen like APPs, whether they're physician assistants or nurse practitioners, kind of complimenting you guys, because what you guys are trained and do, you guys are board certified surgeons, you are able to do certain things. How do you think that role has evolved over the years?
It is absolutely exploded in my time. I've been doing it for 20 years. I'm starting to become an old man. But 20 years ago, when I joined the practice, we didn't have an APP. And when I would go to policy meetings, that was the discussion. It's like, hey, do you have an APP? Are you using one? No, but I think so-and-so has one. Go talk to them about, you know, what that's like. And now almost everybody is utilizing that. They're in their practices. And the utilization, we can talk about sort of how APPs are incorporated onto the team, is extremely variable across practices. But APPs are becoming ubiquitous. And you know, thank heavens, because we the urology workforce from a physician standpoint, MD and DO, is small. It's not getting any bigger. It was at least not getting bigger at a rate that's needed to take care of the population. We absolutely have to have APPs on our team just to help with the volume. You know, when we at the Public Policy Council talk about workforce issues, we have a workforce task force. And that task force couches this as a supply demand issue. So there's so much demand for urologic care, you know, across the country. And by the way, there are 60% of counties in the United States don't have a urologist. And that's kind of a striking feature. And a lot of those are rural, but still, there's a lot of people who are actually pretty far from adequate urologic care. And we have urologic emergencies, and we're starting to see excess morbidity and mortality for lack of urologic care. So APPs are critical to building out that team so that we can you know, give the supply to the demand and continue in that direction. But with respect to your question of sort of how APPs are utilized, it's variable. And I've seen practices that utilize APPs only in the hospital. I've seen practices just as surgical first assists. You know, if you're an APP, you can kind of say, I want a surgical career. I'm going to be a surgical first assist. Others are used in the hospital to do consults and help take call. Others are utilized as part of a team in the office. And that's how, as you know, we do things. Our APPs do go into the hospital to make rounds. We don't use them as surgical first assists, but their central role is taking care of patients in the office. And one of the nice things is that we've really built, opportunity for our APPs, and Joy has three colleagues who are also phenomenal, built opportunities for them to specialize. And it turns out when you give APPs an opportunity to become expert in a sub area of urology, read all the literature, keep up on the literature that's coming up, and stay attuned to what's going on, it's a huge, not only a huge job satisfier, but it's fabulous for our patient populations that need these services. You know, when I see an advanced prostate cancer patient, I'll diagnose them and I'll get them started and I'll say, you're going to follow up with Joy, who's one of the national experts in advanced prostate cancer. He has our oversight, but I trust Joy and he's phenomenal and you're going to love him. And when you tee them up like that, that makes, you know, they come into Joy's office knowing they're coming into one of the national leaders, thought leaders in advanced prostate cancer. And when you work like a team like that, the possibilities are endless. And so, you know, Joy does advanced prostate cancer. One of our others, Melissa Kessler, just started a stone clinic. So she's going to do metabolic stone workups. And Parker has expressed interest in starting a men's health clinic. And so we're going to support him in getting men's health started so he can do Xiaflex, ED evaluations, test, you know, hormone replacement therapy. All of those, you know, sorts of subspecialties are on the table. Again, huge job satisfier and a huge help to handle the patient load as they come in. And that frees up your urologists, assuming, you know, according to, you know, across the audience here, that most listening will be fairly short. I mean, some folks are fortunate and are fully staffed, but most, just statistically, will be short at least one or two urologists. So how do you free up your time to do the surgery that APPs can't do, but also deal with the complex, you know, issues in the office? And there's certainly some really complicated urologic situations that you need the doc to sort of wrap their mind around and pay attention to. But if we're being honest with ourselves, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the office that's pretty straightforward and pretty easy to train up. And APPs can become expert pretty quickly at a lot of this stuff, basic BPH follow-ups, basic stones, you know, those sorts of things. And so we are blessed to have four fabulous APPs, and I think their job satisfaction generally is pretty good because of it. So lots of different ways to incorporate APPs and to help them become part of this team. We desperately need them. They need our oversight and they need our help, but we desperately need them to be part of the team.
No, you're right, because, and as you see, like the trend, AUA has started investing more time and just carve out in the conferences like APP geared education and support so that they feel valued. LUCPA is doing the same thing. I think the goal that I hear you say is if everybody could be supported and we are able to practice at the top of our licensure with oversight, it ultimately will provide a better support for the patient and the community.
So, absolutely, completely agree.
So now, you know, you have been in leadership. How do you think that, from a leadership perspective, that do you think APPs are still like a part of the strategic discussion? They can be a part of the leadership model, or are we still kind of like evaluating how to utilize them because we are not sure, you know, because there is nurse practitioners, there is PAs, you know, two different governing bodies. Those things, that do you think creates a barrier from the senior leadership perspective or just from the administrative perspective, how to utilize them?
Are you talking about within a practice or larger?
I'm just saying within a practice or somebody who has not used, say they're new, they are not sure. How do you think, what are the questions that they may be having to get APPs to better utilize?
Yeah, I mean, it starts by, you know, hiring them and getting them clinically incorporated. And then in terms of, you know, practice leadership, once you get a critical mass of APPs, it makes sense for them to have their own sort of leadership hierarchy. And maybe you have a chief APP who plugs into, you know, a physician executive committee, you know, as your practice gets bigger and bigger. If you're a 4 or 5 person practice, you're not going to have that kind of infrastructure. But a lot of practices now with all the consolidation are 15, 20, sometimes more docs, and sometimes just as many APPs. And so you've got to give APPs, once you get that large, you've got to give them their own leadership infrastructure so that they feel like their voices are heard. And when they have opinions, they're being sent up and being incorporated into how the practice is run. And so I think that's essential as practices get bigger, is to make sure that APPs feel that they have a voice, that they have a leadership chain of command that they can go through when they have grievances, because APPs have their own issues and their own frustrations, yeah. No doubt about it. And there needs to be a sort of an infrastructure and a mechanism whereby that's heard. That's really important.
So like, I know that where I am, I'm supported by all of you all. I mean, if I have a question, I can come up to you. And the part is, there must be a pain point from a physician perspective when you're trying to grow this culture. You know, I mean, what we have today is, it didn't happen overnight, right? Because you guys have supported, kind of went through the growing pains to get that part. So I just want to reach out to you. So somebody, again, when you see not everybody is able to utilize, and the physicians are doing a lot more that they can kind of delegate and kind of sit in the back seat, how would you say that what's the best way to cultivate that culture that you are growing people, like, and to your point that, you know, giving those APPs a purpose and some autonomy so they're enjoying their job?
I know in speaking to colleagues and as part of our larger group, I worked with our CMO to talk with our other practices within our group across the country at one point, just about this topic, about APP utilization. It's just to take the temperature of all the component groups in Arizona and Colorado and other places. We did Zoom calls with practice leaders. You know, what's your attitude? You know, what's your atmosphere for APP utilization in your practice? And it was really all over the place. And I suspect that was a microcosm of what's going on in the broader country across independent practices and probably even in academic practices, although they tend to have different needs for APPs. But if we talk about independent practice, it's really all over the place. And the APPs, it ranges from, they can stay over there and I'll give them a few patients, but let me take care of the urology, to they're vital parts of our practice and we want them to subspecialize and we're going to even feed them patients as we oversee what they're doing. And it's really over the board. And it's individual, you know, urologist attitude. And that comes from, you know, how they were trained and brought up through urology, and what their prior experiences were going to lead to their attitudes towards APP utilization. And we need to allow space for there to be a variety of different, you know, initial attitudes towards it. But I think through both collegial intervention, when you have a colleague at a meeting but comes up and says, hey, we've got phenomenal APPs and they're such a help to our practice, to that person who's not so sure, you know, that starts to sink in a little bit. But, you know, to folks who are kind of wondering about hiring APPs, I think the way to do it is to step in, you know, and it's fine, start slow, you know, and start with some really basic patients. You know, you've got to be willing to train them because they need training in what we do, unless you get an experienced APP from somewhere else who's already up to speed. But you have to train them up. It doesn't take that long, but it does take time and effort. And you will find very quickly, these are very smart professionals. They learn the job quickly, and they will immediately start taking some of the burden of the stuff that's a bit more rote out of your schedule, so that you can focus on the more complex issues in the surgery that you need to be focusing on. Spend more time in the ASC, all of those things. And in a lot of places also, and really important, and you guys have been lifesavers for us in terms of quality of life, in a lot of places they can take first call in front of you. So they have hospital privileges. And they take first call. And a lot of places, calls getting very busy. When you have an APP in front of you, your life changes. If you're primarily responsible for call, especially if you cover three or four hospitals at a time, having an APP on first call, you've got to compensate them for it, of course. But a lot of them are willing to do it because, again, they're willing to be part of a team. They want to be fairly compensated for what they do. But it is an enormous change in lifestyle for you to be able to have a partner in front of you. So that you're just basically getting called. They can go in and do the consult, but you're getting called if you need to go in and do the stent or the procedure or whatever it is. And so it's another area in which that collaboration, where it works, it really, really works well.
I have to kind of touch on the uro-oncology space because, as you know, like in prostate cancer and now the bladder cancer is coming up, there are so many now innovations coming up that are minimally invasive or versus like non-surgical approaches coming in. I think that with APPs getting trained, especially in having crucial conversations, which I personally have been very fortunate to have you to sometimes guide me how to deliver the news, so to speak. I personally feel that in uro-oncology space, APPs, if they're interested, can make a really big dent in helping and kind of deliver care so it's non-fragmented. Just kind of look at the whole picture. Do you agree with that?
I completely agree. You know, the more, non-big surgical capabilities that we have, you know, the ability to sort of deliver advanced medications, chemotherapies, bone health drugs, you know, all of these sorts of things and really provide, you know, wraparound care for the prostate cancer patient. I agree with you. The APPs can be trained and brought along and nurtured to a point where they can handle a lot of that stuff, you know, again, with the, you know, with ultimate oversight from a physician, but they absolutely can handle higher level tasks that don't require the surgical training. And that's really what separates, you know, docs from APPs. It's the time and training, of course,
right,
and the breadth of experience, but the surgical training and the repetition of the surgical training you don't have, but that's okay. There's so much else that you can become expert at and help with and continue to, you continue to become expert at.
And probably also some of the post-ops that are coming through. And if you have cases just to make sure things are done, maybe APPs can support that part, just doing the post-op follow-ups after a major surgery or something. Yeah,
another good point.
So my next question to you is that now that we are embarking on this podcast of expert approach, what do you recommend that would add value to this podcast for the urology audience or uro-oncology audiences?
Yeah, I think it's to continue to talk about, you know, the breadth of topics that we've talked about tonight. You know, we've touched a little bit on innovation, and I certainly don't hold myself out as an expert on technical innovation. You can bring on innovation experts in different areas to talk about, hey, what's in the pipeline? Where's this all going? But you know, policy, you know, always hit on policy because again, how we deliver care and our ability to deliver care, you know, depends on all of these stools, right? It's technology and advances in technology. It's what's going on, in terms of regulation, in terms of law, both at the state and federal level. So you need folks, who sort of have the sense of that, you need researchers, and academicians to come in and get a sense of the temperature of, you know, what's going on in training programs, you know, and how are utilizing APPs and the training programs and what should be looking at, APP training and that landscape, what's that look like? You know, what's the pipeline of APPs in urology look like? How many training programs are there and where are they going? And so I think when you touch on all of those things, one topic we haven't touched on tonight that I think you're going to want to start to touch on is, artificial intelligence and how do we start to incorporate artificial intelligence into urology. From a policy perspective, I'm very excited to announce that we have a new committee. It's the first new committee in many years on the Public Policy Council, and it's the Urology, Telehealth and Technology Committee. And they're going to have their first official meeting at Health Policy Weekend this November. And it's composed of 16 absolute nationwide rock stars in the fields of telehealth and artificial intelligence. These are researchers. These are folks who have touched policy, been involved in federal policy around AI and telehealth. So we're going to have, I'm biased, but I think one of the best subspecialty committees on artificial intelligence and telehealth in the country. And we led the way in telehealth, quite frankly, in COVID. I mean, urologists, because we had a committee set up and we had some of the national experts, and we just hit the ground running when COVID hit and telehealth just took off because of the preparation that we did. So get some folks in from that committee. I'll give you some names who'd be happy to sit down and talk about, you know, so, you know, where does AI fit into this? Where does telehealth fit into all of this? You know, one of the areas where I think where AI in particular is going to have a huge impact is I know you've started to become expert in genetic testing in prostate cancer, in developing genetic, you know, a patient's genetic profile. And that starts to get towards personalized medicine. And so I think that's, you know, one of the futures of advanced prostate cancer is we're going to be able to get genetic profiles together to, and then design treatment programs about around the individual's cancer rather than sort of, you know, larger groupings of prostate cancer, because we're going to know so much more information about that specific individual's cancer. And I think that's an area where we're going to incorporate AI and help us, you know, you input all of this data, you know, and the output is, you know, here are some suggested courses of treatment. You got to have the doc and the APP in the loop, but AI is going to be able to digest volumes and volumes of information about a patient to then spit out, here are suggested courses of action. So it's a really exciting area. So I would suggest, you know, also going forward, you know, incorporate experts in AI, in the technology.
You know, when you said that, I just felt great because I have a podcast coming up with a urologist who is in the AI space. And perfect. So I am glad I'm thinking in the right direction. That's yeah. Good. And to your point with the genetics, now I see how many drugs that are overlinked from one cancer to another. It's phenomenal. It's very rewarding from our perspective. Yeah. Dr. E, thank you so much for taking the time today. And I really I want to make this like known that whatever I have been able to accomplish or learn in urology, you have a huge hand in that. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being so kind and always being so giving. Thank you.
Very kind of you, Joy. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. So to my audience, thanks for being a part of this journey. Your voice, your work, your passion, they're what gives this space the strength. And if you like this show, stick with us, because soon in the next episode, we will sit down with another leader who is driving meaningful change in the urology space. Thank you.